I am very happy to introduce, actually for the second time in 5 or 6 years, Petra Couvet, who is a very good friend of mine as well as a colleague, a Slavist from the University of Leiden. We actually started the first day of our Slavic studies there, and we are some of the handful, less than a handful, we counted, who are actually still doing Slavic studies, so we're proud of ourselves. Petra has been teaching at in Moscow and also at St. Petersburg State University. She has published articles on Russian literature and history of the 20th century. She has translated numerous writers like Pasternak, Tsitsaeva, Akhmedulina, Yelena Schwarz, Nabokov. And this is, of course, her book, The Zhivago Affair, The Kremlin, the CIA, and the Battle Over a Forbidden Book, that she co-wrote with Peter Finn from the Washington Post. And that's actually all she wrote in her bio, but that's not all. No. That book that you will see the cover of later, that book has been translated into Chinese, French, and Dutch. Translations are in preparation in German, Spanish, Croatian, Turkish, and Russian. The film rights are sold to Kosher Films, who did 300? Yeah? It also received several nominations. A nomination for the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award.
2014.
2014?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a typo, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is 2014, the Pushkin House Book Prize finalist with four other books, right? Five total. For the best book on Russian in 2015.
15
Italy, I'm reading. Yes. Best book of the year. Best book of the year list of the Amazon Editor's Pick for the best book of 2014. The Washington Post, the Sunday Times, the Newsday, the Telegraph, St. Louis Post Dispatch, The Spectator, and the Daily Beast. Here we go. New York Review of Books said, a fascinating book that is thoroughly researched, extraordinarily accurate in its factual details, judicious in its judgments, and destined to remain the definite word on the subject for a very long time to come. So please welcome Petra.
Well, now I feel really humble. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Krika, very much for your kind invitation. So my name is Petra Couvet, and the last time I was here in 2009, I gave a talk for Krika on a very tiny part of the comprehensive publication history of the novel Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak. But I was not planning on writing a book at all. But on my way from the Netherlands to Madison, I made a stop in New York, where I met Washington Post journalist Peter Finn, who was also interested in the story and was planning to write it in. And that turned out to be a very significant stop indeed. Only a year later, we decided to join forces, and today I will talk about the book we wrote together, The Zhivago Affair, The Zhivago Affair, The Kremlin, the CIA, and the Battle Over a Forbidden Book. You see the paperbacks here. This is the English one, very outspoken, and then a more subdued one, that is the American one. So, and that deals with the birth and the extraordinary life of the novel Dr. Zhivago and its author, Boris Pasternak. But it has a focus on the first Russian language edition of Dr. Zhivago that was printed at the request of the CIA. I will also talk a little about our research, our finds in the CIA archives, and how they helped debunk speculation that has surrounded this publication for years. So, in early September 1958, copies of a Russian language edition of Dr. Zhivago appeared on the grounds of the Brussels Universal and International Exposition, the first World's Fair to be held since 1939. It was a very fine edition. It was substantial, bound in blue linen, and it was also very odd because there was no known publisher of Dr. Zhivago in Russian. The novel was banned in the Soviet Union, and the first Western publisher, Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli of Milan, who insisted that he controlled the world rights, including Russian, had not contracted for any original language edition. The novel was handed out to Soviet visitors to the Vatican Pavilion at the World's Fair, in Brussels, and soon blue linen covers were littering the fairgrounds as some of those who got the book ripped off the heavy cover to make it easier to stuff in their pockets. The visitors who got copies from the Russian-speaking priest and lay volunteers understood this was an illicit book, best hidden from the KGB minders at the fair. The CIA was behind this publication, closely cooperating with the Dutch intelligence service, the BVD, or the BVD, who organized a secret printing order at Mouton & Co., a distinguished printer and publisher in Den Haag, that recently had specialized in Slavic language books. The CIA used the Vatican Pavilion at the 1958 World's Fair in Brussels to distribute the novel to Russians because a large number of Soviet citizens, some 16,000, had obtained visas to visit the fair, which took place over 6 months between April and October at a 500-acre site just northwest from central Brussels. 43 nations, including the US and the Soviet Union, and for the first time, the Vatican participated. The fair was a Cold War battleground, with both the US and the Soviet Union showcasing their achievements and way of life. The CIA had assumed that Mouton, the Dutch publishing house, was about to get the rights to the Russian language version of Dr. Zhivago from Feltrinelli, and that this edition would be passed off as an advance run. There was good reason for this belief. Mouton had been negotiating with Feltrinelli and was also very confident of securing the Russian language rights. When the company was approached about printing Dr. Zhivago by a leading anti-communist in the Netherlands, Mouton executives thought it would be a very profitable early sale, even though they knew there was something very suspicious about the customer. The deal with Feltrinelli was not finalized, however, and the CIA edition unexpectedly became a pirate one. Around 1,100 copies were printed. That screw-up sparked immediate speculation about who was behind the printing, and the rumors continued for decades. Der Spiegel, the German magazine, wrote almost immediately in 1958, that one of the volunteers at the Vatican Pavilion who was handing out the novel was, quote, associated with a financially vigorous, militant American cultural and propaganda organization which goes under the name Committee for Free Europe. A New York Times book columnist wondered aloud who was behind this Russian edition of Dr. Zhivago that appeared in Brussels and said coyly that the answer was, quote, classified. The speculation continued for years, and some of it quite fanciful, that the British intelligence forced down a plane in Malta that was carrying the Italian publisher Feltrinelli from Moscow, and that MI6 officers secretly photographed the manuscript of Dr. Zhivago, which was in his luggage. The only problem was that Feltrinelli had only ever been to Moscow once, and that was before the novel was finished by Pasternak. And when he did pick it up in September 1956, it was in West Berlin. And flights from Berlin to Milan don't travel via Malta. It was also speculated that the CIA published the novel in Russian to satisfy a rule of the Swedish Academy that a work must be published in its original language to qualify for the Nobel Prize in Literature. But the Academy had said there was no such rule, and there was no copy of the CIA edition in its library or archives. Indeed, an internal CIA accounting of where the books were sent after they were printed in the Netherlands showed that none went to Stockholm. Actually, I was in the archives, and they only had the Michigan one, so no CIA edition. Still, others argued that the CIA's role was minimal, and this was all the work of emigre organization, the agency financed. Bottom line, there were lots of speculation, but few facts. That was still so in 1997, when I came to the story. I interviewed Mouton's executives, Peter de Ridder, and the Dutch-American Slavist Kees van Schoneveld, and Pasternak's close friend and one of his French translators of Dr. Zhivago, Jacqueline de Proyard, who all doubted CIA involvement. They actually denied it. They said there was no CIA involvement. Who planned and paid for the Mouton edition, with what purpose, and why it was done in the Netherlands remained unknown. Requests for intelligence documents in the late summer of 1997 led to nothing. The Dutch intelligence service replied it had no documents on the case, and my reconstruction of the events, based on Dutch, Belgian, French, Russian, German, and American material, concluded with an open end and was published in July 1989 in an Amsterdam literary journal. The article caught the attention of a television journalist of the Dutch First Channel. The story appeared on public television in January 1990 to an audience of a million viewers, which is a lot in the Netherlands. We're a very tiny country. One of which was a former senior officer of the Dutch intelligence, who, after consulting with his former agency colleagues, stated that the CIA was, quote, the initiator and main organizer of the Zhivago project, and that other secret services like MI6 might have been informed, but unlike the BVD, did not any play not any role of significance. There's a little bravado here, you know, this little country, little secret service. Oh, MI6, you know, not important. We were the best. So, yeah, but it's, yeah, but no, I'm sure. So this mission was the first semi-official acknowledgments of the CIA involvement. My co-author Peter Finn wrote about the claim that the CIA published Dr. Zhivago in Russian to win the Nobel Prize in the Washington Post in 27, when he was the newspaper's Moscow bureau chief. And that article led us to start communicating about the Zhivago affair. So our book is partly about the CIA, but mostly about Pasternak and Dr. Zhivago. The decade Pasternak spent writing it, his deeply ambivalent relationship with the Soviet state, the strange bond between him and Stalin, the early hostile response to his novel from the state publisher and literary journals such as Novi Mir, whose editor read the novel as an attack on the October Revolution, and that all flowed from it, and all that flowed from it. Pasternak remained determined to see his book published whatever the cost. He was never imprisoned. He survived the Great Terror, but the Soviet state exploited his messy private life and struck at him indirectly by sending his lover, Olga Ivinskaya, to the Gulag. Pasternak gave the manuscript to a young Italian, Sergio D'Angelo, who worked at Moscow, Radio Moscow, and who also worked as a scout for new books for Feltrinelli, the publisher in Milan. The Kremlin, in conjunction with the Italian Communist Party, attempted to intimidate both the author and the publisher to stop publication in Italy and get the novel back. But they failed. And the extraordinary correspondence between Feltrinelli and Pasternak is a powerful statement to artistic freedom. The struggle to publish the novel led Feltrinelli to break with the Italian Communist Party, of which he was a leading member and financier. And he was the first publisher of Dr. Zhivago, which appeared in translation in Italy in November 1957. It was a commercial and critical success, and helped in part by the publicity surrounding the fact that the Soviets had banned it. Indeed, there is a case to be made that if the Soviet Union had simply allowed a small print run and made no fuss, Dr. Zhivago would have drawn only a small elite readership in the West and not have become the huge international bestseller it did. Like, in the first year in America, it nearly sold 1 million copies. in translation, so that was a lot. Publication followed in 1958 in France, Germany, Britain, and the United States, but, as I said, not in the Soviet Union and not in Russia. The novel was critically acclaimed. The New York Times Book Review wrote that to those who are familiar with Soviet novels of the last 25 years, Pasternak's book came as a surprise. The delight of his literary discovery is mixed with a sense of wonder that Pasternak, who spent all his life in the Soviet environment, could resist all the external pressures and strictures and could conceive and execute a work of utter independence, a broad feeling, and of an unusual imaginative power, amounts almost to a miracle. The great American critic, Edmund Wilson, writing in The New Yorker, said, "Dr. Zhivago will, I believe, come to stand as one of the great events in men's literary and moral history. Nobody could have written it in a totalitarian state and turned it loose on a world who did not have the courage of genius." In October 1958, Pasternak won the Nobel Prize in Literature. The Kremlin treated the award as an anti-Soviet provocation and forced Pasternak to renounce it. The elderly author, he was now 68, was subject to an extraordinary campaign of vilification and described as a traitor and a Judas in the pages of Pravda and by the Kremlin leadership. Pasternak was driven to the brink of suicide. He died 18 months later, and some people, including his son, have said the treatment contributed to his death. Pasternak's funeral, an extraordinary scene which we describe in the book, was attended by a huge crowd and in effect was one of the first public demonstrations in the Soviet Union. Well, that is essentially the arc of the story, from the creation of the novel to Pasternak's death. And as I already said, it is a story that is only partly about the CIA and mostly about Pasternak. And it was a story that hadn't been told as a single narrative in English, at least since Robert's conquest, the Pasternak Affair, in 1961. He passed away last summer, and in our title there is some homage to his work, as there is to the works of so many translators, writers, journalists, scholars, that greatly facilitated our book by their previous research. The enormous amount of material had emerged since I wrote my first articles in the late 90s. Pasternak's son Yevgeny and his wife Yevgenia had assembled Pasternak's collective works in 11 volumes, including his vast correspondence, plus memories of friends and relatives. During the years we were writing the book, I lived and worked in St. Petersburg, all of which helped to observe the Russian material about Pasternak, the novel, and the work in the Russian archives. And that is a challenge, as some of you may know, who have done research in Russia. But Peter and I first sought a copy of a letter to Khrushchev written by Olga Ivinskaya, Pasternak's lover. Several archives said they didn't have it. I found it, though, in the State Archive of the Russian Federation. It took some very long conversations before one librarian, complaining that Westerners are obsessed with Russian repression, agreed to look for it. And when we got it, including the letter to Khrushchev, it was in such a bad shape, torn and crumbled. And we were told that it was impossible to copy the entire file without permission from the chief archivist. And so we decided to settle for most, but not all, of the file, which was about 60 pages in total. I think that successful work in Russian archives requires not only patience and persistence, but also an ability to switch between charm and bellicosity. Yeah, you really need... They sent me back 3 times, and I had to travel very far. And the last time I said, do you have a stretcher? Because I'm not going away anymore. I'm going to stay here. And then she kind of panicked. And yes, yes, yes. So you need to be sometimes. And some Dutch swearing also helps. Really, sounds really bad, but, you know, it works. So when Peter and I first started to talk about the book, we agreed that the backstory of the novel was worth telling on its own, but we also thought that any book should try and bring something fresh and original to the table. The obvious outstanding question was the role of the CIA. The documents we sought from the CIA were over 50 years old, and Peter approached the agency in 2009 after he returned to DC from Moscow. And that was the first time anyone asked for the Zhivago files. The first response he got back from the Office of Public Affairs was that the agency was not interested in cooperating with the book by declassifying any documents it might have. And we understood that all CIA records regarding covert operations, past or present, are exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. The records would only be released if the agency chose to release them or was persuaded to release them. Requests under the Freedom of Information Act could simply be denied. Instead, he spoke to a number of retired officers through whose good services the subject of our book was brought to the attention of the Historical Records Division. Peter met with CIA officials, including from the Historical Records Division, several times before the agency agreed to see what records it had and whether they could be declassified. But we got the documents in a redacted form in August 2012. In fact, Peter received the CIA documents in the regular mail sent to his house, his home in Virginia. And the CIA released approximately 135 previously classified internal documents about its involvement in the printing of two Russian language editions of the book. The hardback edition that we saw that was distributed in Brussels, and a paperback edition printed at CIA headquarters the following year. The CIA's in-house historian found and reviewed the agency's documentation and oversaw the internal declassification process. We were able to look into these documents before they were publicly released, and the CIA placed no condition on our use of the documents and did not review any section of our book. While some secrets are held forever, many need not be. It goes without saying that the agency's history and the story of its officers and operation is part of a broader history and deserves to be told. And that includes the book program that saw the CIA underwrite the translation and publication of millions of books and journals, literature, including Joyce, Hemingway, Nabokov, but also books on history, psychology, and sociology. It was described by one of its participants as the Marshall Plan of the mind, and it still awaits a full history. What was most striking about the material was the enthusiasm of the officers writing about Dr. Zhivago in internal memos. Here's John Murray, the Soviet Russia division chief, writing in July 1958 when the printing operation was already underway. Pasternak's humanistic message that every person is entitled to a private life and deserves respect as a human being, irrespective of the extent of his political loyalty or contribution to the state, poses a fundamental challenge to the Soviet ethic and of sacrifice of the individual to the communist system. There is no call to revolt against the regime in the novel, but the heresy which Dr. Zhivago preaches, political passivity, is fundamental. Pasternak suggests that the small, unimportant people who remain passive to the regime's demands for active participation and emotional involvement in official campaigns are superior to the political activist favored by the system. Further, he dares hint that society might function better without these fanatics. There are several memos like this which suggest a close reading of the novel at CIA. We quote them in the book, And they can also be read in full at the site CIA.gov. So you can look at all these documents. They're hard to read because they're redacted. It's a bit of a puzzle, but you know, if you have nothing to do on a Sunday, you can do it. We were also a little disappointed, you know, we got this kind of, you know, a pack of paper, and we thought, and I, you know, I was working on this story for so long, and I thought, this is the key. And I got them in Milan, where we saw each other, and I was sitting in a park, and I was so disappointed, it was so hard to read, and but, you know. Okay.
They completely blacked out?
No, they don't. There were the names, organizations, but it was, you know, you could read if you just sit and thoroughly read it, but it was, I just wanted to have the key instantly, but that was not like that. So there was also an emphasis on secrecy to protect Pasternak. Two rolls of film of the photographed manuscript were first provided by the British intelligence, which insisted there be no overt American involvement in a printing in case it would it could be used by the Soviet authorities to hurt Pasternak. That warning was followed by another from one of the British translators of Dr. Zhivago, George Katkov, who told the consul in Munich that Pasternak had recently noted in a private conversation with one of the French translators that he didn't want the book published in Russian by emigres, by US-funded groups, or in the US. Katkov said this had no anti-American implications. It was just a matter of personal safety for Pasternak. That cable about Katkov's visit Peter found in the State Department records marked Soviet censorship at the National Archives, and it was a wonderful, enlightening little find. Mm-hmm. That's one of the great pleasures of doing research, I mean, to find the unexpected, and it is it makes up for all the hundreds of files you're going through where there's nothing relevant. So I won't go into details leading up to the Dr. Zhivago publication in Russian by the CIA in the Netherlands, because that was the theme of my previous talk in 2009, and I also hope that you will actually read our book. Let me just say that the first publisher the agency contracted was a very charming ex-Trotskyist, a cold warrior who was utterly unreliable when it came to keeping secrets, and to the consternation of some at CIA headquarters, the operation threatened to become some kind of a theater of the absurd. That led the agency to turn to the Dutch intelligence service, the BVD, and to the printing in The Hague. So to our surprise, that was really the biggest find. The CIA, let me take some water first. The CIA decided after the award of the Nobel Prize to do a second printing of Dr. Zhivago. There were some lessons to be learned from the first. The Mouton book was too bulky, too blue, too heavy, you know, and involving outsiders was nothing but trouble. The second edition was a mini paperback on Bible stock paper that came in one and two volumes, so it could be easily smuggled, quote, inside a man's suit or trouser pocket, as one of the CIA manos put it. Inside the government, there was also a strong sense that the US should not overplay its hand during the Nobel crisis, and that the grotesque treatment of Pasternak was playing out in newspapers across the world and shocking people, including countries friendly to the Soviet Union. Instead, officials in Washington relished what they saw as a propaganda coup that was entirely manufactured in Moscow. At a meeting of State Department senior staff with John Foster Dulles, the communist treatment... He was told that the communist treatment of Pasternak was one of their worst blunders. It is on par in terms of embarrassment and damage to them with the brutality in Hungary. By July 1959, 8 months after the Nobel crisis, about 5,000 miniature copies had been printed in Washington, and the printing was attributed to a fictitious publishing house. And I show you. Oh no. Maybe you can see it, otherwise I read it. Société d'édition d'impression mondiale. It's a lot of air. Société d'impression. You already feel that something isn't right there. A Russian emigre group in Germany essentially said it was behind the printing. And that secret basically held until the release of the documents, as it was widely believed that this miniature edition was the work of emigres. According to one CIA document, the books were passed out by agents who had contact with Soviet officials and tourists in the West. 2,000 copies were set aside for dissemination to Soviet and other communist students at the World Festival of Youth and Students for Peace and Friendship, which was held in Vienna in late July and early August 1959. It was the first such youth festival held outside the Soviet bloc and attracted thousands of students, including from the developing world. All of the festivities and cost underwritten by the Soviet Union. The festival was personally supervised by the head of the KGB, Alexander Shilyapin, who previously had been president of the International Union of Students. The CIA underwrote the cost of sending young Americans to the festival, basically to disrupt it by having them mix and debate with their Soviet and communist counterparts. A colleague of Peter at the Washington Post, Walter Pincus, who was there, described it as a college weekend with Russians. And I... Yeah. To give you an idea of the festival's atmosphere, here you see a Christ-like image of Pasternak. Do you see it here? Yeah? And he has a crown of thorns with barbed wire. And you see above, you see Justitia Regnorum Fundamentum, which is justice is the fundament of kingdoms. And below, in German, you see Erst Freiheit und dann Festspiele, which is first freedom and then festivals. So, I don't know. It's a little different from a festival you have now, but yeah. Among the activities in Vienna was the distribution of books in many languages, 30,000 in 14 languages, including 1984, Animal Farm, and The God That Failed. Apart from the Russian edition of Dr. Zhivago, it was available in Polish, a German, Czech, Hungarian, and Chinese at the festival. The novel had been published in Taiwan, and the Free Europe Committee flew in 50 copies for the 400-strong Chinese delegation, which proved to be utterly impenetrable. Some of the Chinese wouldn't even talk to their Soviet and Eastern European comrades. The Soviet delegation arrived from Budapest in a convoy of buses. It was a blistering hot day, and the windows were open. When they reached Vienna, and they were moving through the streets, the buses were swarmed by emigres who tossed the miniature copies of Dr. Zhivago through the windows. The KGB was obviously aware of all these and other efforts to distribute the novel in Vienna, yet they proved not to be so harsh with the students who picked up the books, as one might suspect. One student, writing many years later in Russia, said the agents told them, "Take it, read it, buy books. But by no means bring it home." So how successful was the CIA operation? Beyond simply printing the books, the CIA wanted to add to the sense globally that the Soviet Union's censorship of its writers was crude and cruel, especially after Pasternak gotten the Nobel Prize in October 1958 and forced to renounce it, and was subjected to a hate campaign which caused a serious damage to the Soviet image worldwide. How many CIA copies made it through and were subsequently read, we will probably never know. But it is true that copies were sold on the black market in Moscow and Leningrad for reported prices of 200, 300 rubles, which was almost like a week wages for a worker, and passed hand to hand by Russians. We also found a CIA edition in the Moscow State Library, formerly Leninka, or the Lenin Library, which where it was held in closed section in Soviet times. And I learned from a former employee that the copy was handed out in Brussels, that it was intercepted by the Soviet customs, either in a parcel or in a suitcase, and eventually made its way to the library. The inside cover, I don't know if you can see it, but this is what I found, was affixed with one purple hexagonal stamp by its censor, and it's here, which was number 124. And I was very curious. I'm always very curious about censors. These were people, you know. Who were they? So I tried to find out who he or she was. And it turned out very much to be somebody like you and me. I mean, she studied languages. She was fluent in Turkish, and she was well-read and a very friendly person. So you think, this is the enemy. She puts a stamp in this wonderful novel, and it turns out to be, you know, a very nice lady. At least that's what they said.
Do you know what the rubber stamps say?
Yeah, I know them all. You want to know them?
Yeah.
Well, it basically means, so this is the censor. This is, it's not so, this is, it says that you can't copy it, but this is basically all after 1990.
Uh-huh.
So when the book came out of the special collections, mm-hmm. lots of people wanted to read it, and they made a microfilm of it. And I think that's what says one of these stamps. There were also different colors, and I can't really see it, what it is, but it basically meant this is a very, very special copy. And you can't read it.
Uh-huh.
Now you can, but it was, I copied it, but it says you can't copy it, you know, because, but I did.
When did it become legalized first over there?
I'll tell you.
Oh.
Don't be too fast. I'll tell you. So, so the stamp said, so one stamp said that it was under embargo, but it could be read, by people in the reading group, and by members of the Communist Party, by professors, PhD students, and so on. But when I asked the employee who was then working, she was a very, very old lady, and she told me, no, it had one stamp, but nobody ever read it during Soviet times. Nobody. And she also said there was such a social control. So there was this special collection rooms. There were these people that were very interested in reading Nabokov, Lolita, or the Talmud, or the Bible, or everything that was censored. And also, you know, journals like Der Stern, the German journal, which had a lot of royalty. She said, oh, I wanted so much to read the royalty. But there was social control, and nobody dared to do it. So, there was no Dr. Zhivago in the shops, it could not be read in the library, but still the novel had a small but intense readership in the USSR. In the early days, while writing the book, Pasternak held readings at his dacha in Peredelkino and in the homes of friends. And since the spirit of the novel was so controversial, he was cautious and tried out his freshly written chapters on his close friends and trusted colleagues. He also gave chapters to friends and asked for feedback. And to those who were familiar with Soviet novels, Pasternak's book came as a surprise, and to some of them, it was completely alien, and they found themselves perplexed by it, like the children's writer and critic Kalinin Chukovsky, who wrote in his diary, "For all the charm of certain passages, it struck me as alien, confusing, and removed from my life. Much of it failed to involve me." But his daughter, the writer Lydia Chukovskaya, was completely enchanted by it. She wrote, "Already for a day, I don't eat, sleep, exist. I'm reading the novel from beginning to end, and again from the end, and in parts. and I read your novel like a letter addressed to me, and I feel like carrying it in my bag all the time so that at any moment I can take it out, convince myself it's still there, and reread my favorite passages. After the CIA edition and other Western-produced Russian editions, copies started to circulate all over the country. It is the early days of what we call the samizdatchi, self-publishing tradition, a way of dissident activity across the whole Soviet bloc to avoid official censorship, in which people reproduced forbidden publication by hand and passed them from reader to reader. And that was very dangerous indeed, because if you got caught possessing or copying material, you could receive harsh punishment. Ironically enough, one of those clandestine readers of Dr. Zhivago was Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, who had forbidden the novel. But in retirement, after he was ousted by his colleagues, his son gave him a typewritten samizdat copy, and it took him a very long time to read. And he concluded, we shouldn't have banned it, you know? Yeah. That's good thinking. In the hindsight, there was nothing anti-Soviet in it. Pasternak became a model for a line of courageous Soviet writers who followed his example of uncensored publishing. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and the Nobel Prize winner, the poet Joseph Brodsky. And Dr. Zhivago was officially published in 1988 after the relaxation of censorship. A colleague of mine in St. Petersburg told me she read the novel in the late 70s, beginning 80s, when it was semi-surreptitiously handed over to her by her teacher of Russian after class. It was in a sort of newspaper format, badly printed, lousy paper, it had a penetrant, smelly ink, and it was very hard to read, but she greatly, greatly enjoyed the book. But she admitted that she was disappointed when she read it for a second time after it was published officially. Today there's much discussion about different and changing ways of reading. Well, I do know one thing of all the people I interviewed, that there's nothing more exciting than to read a forbidden book. Pasternak never knew that the CIA was behind the first printing in Russia. He did learn about the edition distributed in Brussels from an article in Der Spiegel, and from that he probably believed that it was the work of emigres closely tied to the United States. He did eventually see the book, but he didn't know that the CIA was behind it, but he wasn't very happy. The manuscript the CIA worked off was uncorrected, and Pasternak found it riddled with errors. He asked his French translator, Jacqueline Poyard, to oversee a true edition, which later became the revised University of Michigan edition. I think Pasternak would have been unhappy to learn that the CIA had the novel printed. He hated when Western press selectively quoted from the novel to play up its anti-Soviet character. Pasternak preferred to think of himself and the novel as above politics. He regarded Dr. Zhivago as the culmination of his life's work, my final happiness and madness, he called it. He was completely determined to have the novel published and to gain as wide an audience as possible. But he also did not want Dr. Zhivago exploited for political purposes. But in conclusion, it is also fair to say that Cold War politics contributed to finding this wide audience and to the worldwide and long-lasting success of Dr. Zhivago. Thank you. So, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer if I can. Yeah. Please.
Real briefly, so there were some mistakes in the version that Pasternak saw that were eventually corrected in the University of Michigan. Were they just typos or more than that?
Now, well, I saw Jacqueline Poyard this summer, and I asked her about it, and it was mainly typos, mainly typos, yeah. And a few things she, you know, she rewrote, but she was asking, they were in correspondence, so it was authorized, but there were mainly, what I know, mainly typos. Yes?
I was going to say, it's interesting you brought up the question of the pro-Soviet international festivals of youth and students.
Yeah.
Because that was often a problem for the authorities. I know it was in East Berlin in 73, and then in Cuba in 78, because it provided, an unusually large influx of foreigners, who many of them who did not come from the socialist bloc, and they brought a lot of their customs and behavior with them, and that was difficult for the authorities to deal with in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had a question, was there any official reaction when the movie came out in around 1969, and was there any effort made to distribute that in Eastern Europe?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Never distributed.
No, that's hard, of course, but no, I don't know of an official reaction or response to the movie.
Uh-huh.
No. We did mention the movie, you know, but it was a little, I didn't ask him for it.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Yes?
I went to a talk yesterday about the Vatican and sort of their anti-communist activities during this period, so I was wondering how involved they were in deciding to do the passing out.
Yeah.
If they were working with the Church of the Americans.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I did a lot of research, you know, doing that, because it was very hard to find. And but I found that there was this Russian-Ukrainian group that, you know, they heard that there were so many Russians coming to the festival, and they actually went to see. They were in contact with the people that set up the pavilion, and they asked if they could set up a library, just a library, you know, to distribute Bibles and religious stuff. And then they also decided to hand out more spiritual literature, like Dudintsev, you know that, right? No, well, it was Tolstoy, Dostoevsky. No, it was Dostoevsky. And in the late, in the last month, they got Dr. Zhivago. And it was the main target of the CIA to get that book there distributed. And the people, from the Vatican Pavilion, they were, or at least that Russian working group, they were people that flee the Soviet Union, and they were very anti-communist and believers. So they were very, they were very convinced to do it. They had no doubts.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't mind it was political at all. Yeah, yeah. And there were actually a bunch of. I mean, there were two Russian-speaking priests. One of them who actually got, I looked into his life, he worked there, but he got homesick to Russia. And there's a great story about him that he went to another youth festival in Helsinki.
Mm-hmm.
And it was said that he was kidnapped by the KGB. And he was brought back to Leningrad. And people feared for his life because they were afraid that he would end up, you know, in a camp. But he went back to his village in Ukraine, and he had a wife and children there, and he lived on, and he gave services in his house. So it's actually a good story. Yeah. But there were also people working for the CIA, people the CIA hired.
I had a question about the cover page, not the cover page, the title page of
yeah.
the book. I think it was two slides ago. So you said it was the CIA version that was confiscated, but the publisher at the bottom says Milan and the
yeah.
name of the Italian publisher. So
yeah,
I was wondering,
that's true.
Was this just a ruse
the
of
first,
the CIA
the first.
To make it seem as though the Italian communists had
of
brought
course.
It out?
Okay. Yeah, of course. It was, they hoped they could get an advance run. So there was already a contract in the making. So they knew about it. but they had their target was to distribute it at the Brussels Fair, and the Brussels Fair was closing in October, so they needed to hurry up. And Feltrinelli was very slow, very slow. He just wanted to control, you know, his world wild rights, and so they said, okay, we're not going to wait for him, so we need this early printing. And what they did, actually, the Dutch publisher, he put in Feltrinelli without a Miachi's knack, so everybody could see, you know, that's strange. And they said it was because they wanted to protect Pasternak, mm-hmm. but it was also a very self-serving argument, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I was going to say, there's also interesting examples where the Soviets did exactly the same thing, generating black propaganda, you know, that didn't have any apparent connection to the KGB. One example was something a photographer called American Pictures. It was a book and also a traveling presentation by a Danish photographer. But, I mean, it just showed only negative aspects of the U.S. And I read later on that that was heavily financed by the KGB,
yeah.
for example.
They actually had ghostwriters also writing propaganda. Mm-hmm. I wanted to investigate that as well, but, you know, that was too much. But, yeah, they had books written, you know, anti-American propaganda.
Yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
true. Yeah, so it was a Cold War. I mean, they mm-hmm. were battling, obviously.
Any questions for Peter? No. Where can we get a copy of your book?
Amazon.
Or your local bookseller?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I went to a bookshop here, but it said bookshop, but there were only shirts and stuff. And a few. Yeah. So that was strange. And no, there was not my book, but Amazon has it, yeah. So you can find a Kindle edition and a paperback.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for coming this afternoon, and thanks
to
our speaker,
attention.
Petra. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.